Good afternoon. Welcome to the Wednesday edition of the Daily Friend podcast. I'm joined today by three of my colleagues. Good afternoon to Terence Corrigan.
Good afternoon, Marius. How are you?
And good afternoon to Ian Crookshanks.
Hi, Marius. Good to see you.
And we've got a special guest all the way from the Cape, the indefatigable Michael Morris.
Hello, Marius. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
No problem, Michael. Hope you have a good debut today.
Indeed, thank you.
So we've got a couple of things to talk about. So I think what we're going to start with is something we've been seeing happening in China, is what's happening with the Uyghur people in China. And Terence, do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, China's been in the news for many of the wrong reasons of late. It's the situation in Hong Kong. And this issue in Xinjiang with the Uyghur minority, that's been boiling for not so much a couple of years, but a couple of decades. It's an ethnically distinct group that lives in the west of China. They are Turkic as opposed to Han Chinese.
They're Muslim people, most likely.
Overwhelmingly. Now, China's official stance on its national minorities, if you like, is that they are full citizens. They're even given certain privileges, at least legally or theoretically. But China, and once again, I think this goes very deep into its history. China was the state of the Han Chinese. So, you know, when people when the Chinese diplomat, you know, says to me that, you know, we believe in democracy and human rights with a Chinese understanding, they're coming from a very distinct cultural place, and I think it's very difficult for outsiders to fully comprehend that. Xinjiang is, of course, not where the economic growth happens, and since 2017. There have been reports about mass internments of Uyghur people. The population is estimated about 11 to 12 million, and it's estimated that means 1 million have passed through these centers. Now, the Chinese government says this is all about combating extremism, doing vocational training, but there seems to be something much more sinister happening. And why this has popped into the news this week is because there's been a sort of data dump very much on the WikiLeaks pattern called the Chinese cables, or the China cables, which supposedly, and linguists and China watchers suggest these are genuine, show instructions for the way these facilities are to be managed, very, very tight control, right down to, you know, when people can use the bathroom and when they should be accompanied and how keys should be safeguarded.
Are these concentration camps or not?
Are these concentration camps, not in the sort of Nazi extermination mold, but, you know, a sort of 21st century re-education camp. I think that's very, very would be accurate. I mean, there's been reports, for instance, they've been forced to eat pork and to disavow Islam.
So it's a Sino gulag, can we call it that?
Yes, that may not be too far off base. It certainly doesn't just seem to be about teaching people useful skills. The other thing is the way, but and I think, you know, why I say it's a 21st century gulag, if you like, is the extent of and the use to which modern information technology has been put. Apparently, as part of the Chinese state's monitoring and management of the situation, they're using things like Wi-Fi sniffers, you know, which track your browsing patterns, and tracking the apps on people's phones, spyware being loaded. And that gives them the a sort of profile of those people they consider to be high risk, and they can simply be removed then.
Removed, do I mean Tipex out of the telephone book?
Not Tipex out of the telephone book, but, you know, taken to one of these centers. It's not necessarily about anyone disappearing permanently, but it shows the really sinister application of technology to counter civic protest. Now, you think about this, that China has been setting up the social credit system where, you know, CCTV cameras will track you, and then, you know,
It's very dystopian.
Very dystopian, but this is the world that we are now standing at the doorstep of.
Another interesting thing that happened with China this or last week or this week, that a man called Nick Zhao was found dead in a Melbourne hotel in March 2018, or 2019 rather actually, and it emerged that in 2018 he approached the Australian Secret Service to tell them he'd been approached by a Chinese spy ring who'd offered to pay $1 million for him to stand as a member of parliament in Australia, but obviously be a Chinese government asset. And something similar happened in the Australian Western Australian Legislative Assembly and also in the New Zealand parliament. So it's quite clear that China's starting to flex its muscles, and we're probably looking at a new Cold War type situation, I think.
Well, I think once again, it'll be a 21st century Cold War, you know, where people are much more integrated. I remember reading a figure that in its heyday, the Soviet Union didn't export as much as Belgium. China's a very, very different prospect. China in some ways is more closed than the Soviet Union was, but in some ways much more open. Speaking to people who visited Moscow in the 70s and 80s, there really was this pall hanging over it. And, you know, having been to China myself, China on the surface doesn't really give you that appearance. What China is doing, which I don't think is properly appreciated, is that it's not just leveraging its political power, its economic power, misbehaving like great powers typically do. What you said doesn't particularly surprise me. I'm pretty sure there's not the only government in the world that's trying to do stuff like that.
The Russians are interfering all over the place.
But what you have with the Chinese is the sense that they are the custodians of Chinese culture. Now all over Southeast Asia you have Chinese communities, and the Chinese government has taken it upon itself to sort of intervene on their behalf, to encourage things like the use of Mandarin rather than English. Expatriates who are of Chinese extraction living in China often find themselves under enormous pressure to somehow, you know, rejoin the home team. I think even an American ambassador found himself in this position. It's a confluence of forces that we haven't seen before, and I don't think that there's a modern era precedent for it.
Mm. I think also China's trying to use its soft power in an interesting way with these Confucius Institutes it sets up all over the world, and paying for Chinese study departments in universities around the world, which is also apparently having a bit of an effect on free speech, where people are discouraged from speaking out against China on university campuses. We also saw that the Chinese apparently have a stake in Second Jalo, I think. Mm. And we've seen, I can't remember the chap's name, but he wrote an article critical of the Chinese government. I think it was actually on the Uyghur issue. Mm. And he was this column was stopped and he claimed it was because he'd been critical of the Chinese government. Yeah. So
there you go. You can go beyond that. China is now becoming a significant player in popular culture, movies, and that sort of thing. They're putting a great deal of money into films that you just wouldn't associate with them. You know, sort of set in America with American actors or whatever, but they are produced with the a Chinese release in mind.
Well, I remember when they made the remake of Red Dawn, the baddies were originally going to be Chinese and they changed to North Koreans.
Mm-hmm. Well, more recently there was the Top Gun sequel, where in the trailer at any rate, I'm looking forward to seeing when it comes out, where Tom Cruise takes out his jacket and you notice the Japanese and the Taiwanese flags, which are very, very clearly there in the original, have been changed to sort of meaningless, geometric shapes. If anybody saw The Meg, I may be the only one who enjoys schlocky B movies. The interesting thing about that was that represented a kind of orthodox shark destruction film, but set very much in a Chinese environment. So you see, rather than attacking Florida or California, it's
Like Hong Kong or something.
Well, it was a beach in China, which I remember looking up and actually does exist. So, you know, for the Chinese, there's very much a sense of demanding to be taken taken seriously as a as an equal cultural pole with America, with Europe. I mean, you know, very few people watching a movie set in New York or Paris, even if they've never been to those cities, would be, you know, there's a sense that you kind of know them. We don't have that yet about China, but, you know, that is sort of what they're striving for. And with that sort of normalization or that perceived familiarity comes, you know, accepting the idea that there's a Chinese way of doing things. And I've heard this from some very intelligent people. And it's quite jarring when you
well, we have it in international development with state-led capitalism and all this kind of thing. Mm. So, but I think if there anybody who's 17 or so and they're listening to this podcast, signing up for a course in Mandarin next year when you go to university is probably not a bad idea. So, but I think leaving China, let's come back to South Africa. And Ian, last week we had, I think it was last week, the latest inflation figures came out, and they were actually pretty low. They were, I think, about 4.1% or something like that, so on annual inflation.
Yes.
But that's actually not such a good thing, actually.
It was the lowest level it had been in some years, but it's not just because prices have been held down. It's because there are no buyers to pull them down. Demand pull inflation has disappeared altogether, and cost push inflation has just gradually retreated. That means that the cost of making manufacturing goods has not been able to increase with greater demand, which there hasn't been greater demand anyway. And I think that this is it's following a world trend of lower output prices. It's not necessarily good for us because every manufacturer, every producer is working on margins that are incredibly slim.
Surely 4% inflation is better than, say, 10 or 20% inflation.
Oh, undoubtedly. There's a big difference there. But what it means is that government or the Reserve Bank's aim of getting somewhere in the midpoint between 3 and 6%, which is the target range, so that means a midpoint of 4.5%, is likely to be achieved. And what they're looking at now, the Reserve Bank after this said, they can see that it can stay around this level, maybe up to 5% in the next year or so. That does then give some hope that certainly interest rates won't be hiked. And it's a possibility that they could be reduced, provided the threat of a capital outflow diminishes somewhat. And I'd just like to make a comment to go back to China. You know, there's a lot of discussion about China and you concentrating on it. What I'd like to say is, how is the Chinese economy doing? Well, I looked at Hong Kong as a starting point because, after all, Hong Kong's biggest export customer is China. And what I saw was that Hong Kong's exports, which majority go to China, have declined for the 12th month in a row. And so they're now looking at the possibility of a recession being confirmed. And I think that's very worrying for all of certainly the emerging market and for developed market economies too. It just means there's going to be less activity, and we're seeing it in our own data. If I could just go on that. What we saw today was the business confidence index come out. Hooray, it went up from 22 points to 26 points. Yes, but what I'd like to say, that 22 points was a 20-year low.
But isn't that like being the tallest dwarf?
Yeah.
Or something really to celebrate?
It's not a cause for celebration. It just says that the midpoint around 50 is still a heck of a long way away. And I think that is very accurately describing the state of business. Mostly low activity, low demand. That's why we have low inflation, and it looks like it's likely to stay that way. And just that's been repeated in the Bureau for Economic Research Business Confidence Index. That is marginally up, but still from a very low base. All of these indices are pointing towards statements being made, like the BER said that the current situation was very much like an economy bumbling along at a low level, very close to recession.
I think bumbling is probably a very charitable way to describe what's happening in the economy at the moment. More drunken leopard crawling probably is what you could call it.
Yeah. So what does it mean to us? That's really what counts. What it means is that there's going to be little or no new business creation. There's no fixed investment, so there are no new jobs. Unemployment is at risk of going higher still, and I think that's what we'll see in the next 6 months or so. So, and the Reserve Bank's leading cycle indicator, came out last week, and that is an indicator of 6 to 9 months ahead. And that was certainly falling down again, and so doesn't look like we see a recovery before the middle of next year. I think we must, business and commerce must be prepared for that.
Well, we also saw the IMF came out recently and said the outlook for us is quite bleak at the moment, and there's nothing that I can see that indicates that anything's going to change, I'm afraid.
The IMF take a very good independent long-term view, and they face reality. It's time for us to do the same.
Agreed.
And quite striking that I think they concluded their remark with the words, you know, time is of the essence. We're running out of time. We don't have a lot of time to play with, and it's time that South Africa took action on the economic front.
Mm. They also mentioned the threat of recession as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But we're probably already in a recession. But Michael, do you have anything to add to our discussion today?
Yes, I mean, in contrast to these, the kind of hard crises which the country faces, it's been an intriguing week on the softer side, if you like. And the two things that I'm thinking of are Jesse Duarte's comments, which I think the podcast on Monday dealt with. But quite striking that in contrast to that, we have the president writing his desk of the president letter to South Africans, in which he dwelled almost entirely on the issue of race and transformation, and he refers to the government's own efforts here in this sense, that of all the achievements since the advent of democracy in 1994, perhaps our most important is our sustained and unwavering commitment to transformation and non-racialism. Well, listening to Jesse Duarte, you might be doubtful about that, but
are they in the same party, you wonder?
Yeah. But what I did find, you know, essentially unfortunate. It's despairing in a way to read this line of thinking, is where he refers to the Commission of Employment Equity report in August, and he says, you know, the outcomes suggest, and these are his words, either poor adherence to employment equity legislation and at worst outright disregard for the law, which implies a kind of willful a lack of commitment among ordinary South Africans, among business people, to the kind of society that we all want to see created, a fair one, a just one, and one in which people have a stake. And he then goes on to, you know, make that contrast, draw the contrast between the white men who dominate the upper management levels of private companies, yet make up just 5% of the economically active population, whereas Africans make up only 15%, while accounting for 79% of that population group, economically active people. And the thing that appears to come from this is the idea that the government, the ANC, and perhaps Ramaphosa himself believe that white people are to blame for the problem, when in fact the issues we've been discussing about the economy, about growth, and poor education and so on, these are really where these are the issues that deserve all the attention and which aren't getting it.
But I think we need to redefine what transformation means. I mentioned this the other day too. And transformation isn't replacing white people with black people.
Yeah.
It's creating a country where we don't have 40% unemployment,
yeah,
which we don't have. I'm not sure about the figures now, but I think about half of all South Africans live in poverty. It's a country where 80% of our kids don't go to dysfunctional schools. I mean, that's true transformation.
Yeah,
of course, exactly. You do need these, I don't want to call them cosmetic changes, but it is probably unsustainable to have a country where white people make up 8% of the population, make up 80% of the CEOs, for example. But I mean, I honestly don't think that's the most pressing issue for South Africa at the moment.
No.
I think if you ask, I always make the example of these poor fellows who, most of us who live in the big cities, probably you're familiar with them, the guys who dig through rubbish on rubbish day looking for what you can recycle. I mean, how is BE or Employment Equity helping that guy who's waking up at whatever, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning to go dig through people's rubbish just so he can make a living for himself?
Sure.
I mean, that's not helping those types of guys. And those are the types of guys we actually got to start thinking about, and what policies are going to help these guys have the kind of work that's dignified and sustainable and provides them with the income and opportunity to make a better life for themselves and their family.
Exactly. So, exactly. And people are, you know, the more I go out and about and you chat to people, only today I was in an Uber taxi and chatting to the guy. He's essentially holding down three jobs. You know, he's doing tutoring and accounting. He drives an Uber and he does books for small companies in his neighborhood. Real enterprise, great initiative, lots of energy. But in the environment that he's operating in, the opportunities are just too small for him really to thrive as he deserves to.
Exactly.
And for other people to, as you say, with poor schooling, other people to follow in his footsteps and become an accounting tutor for trick kids.
Terence, did you want to say something?
Yeah, well, I think that I always find it interesting when people in government raise the Employment Equity Commission's reports. I looked through the last one very, very carefully because it attracted a great deal of commentary and condemnation. It was interesting that it never offered any explanation, any analysis of why this is so. It's simply a bean counting exercise, there's a cynical, but perhaps not entirely misguided, a part of me that says that to look too closely at that question is to open some some doors that the government would rather keep shut.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's, you know, something talking about race or ascriptive divides. They're useful for politicians because it's something that people might sort of be able to feel on a very visceral level. To talk about more complex and I think more meaningful things like getting schools working. Those are complicated things, man. I mean,
they're difficult.
Yeah, you know, and the solutions are not always obvious. I'm often reminded of debate in the UK discussion with Jordan Peterson in the UK where someone said, "Don't you think climate change is the thing that could unite us?" And he just said, "No," and everyone kind of laughed nervously. He said, "I don't." He says, "This is complicated stuff. We don't really know what to do about it." You know, it's also got to contend with many other problems. Now, you know, he's not a climate change skeptic. But, you know, he said that nobody really has a solution to this. Mm-hmm. So, no, this is not going to unite us. Mm. In the issue of the racial distribution of employment, I mean, yeah, you know, there is a nationalist impulse. You know, people simply want more people who look like them in particular jobs, you know. And they would rather have that and fewer opportunities.
Just to speak about inequality trends in South Africa, and I think this just shows how opportunities have been restricted to for a lot of people. All the headlines when this Stats SA's latest inequality report came out was about how high inequality is, and there's big differences between white and black incomes, which is all very true. But something that was ignored is that inequality has actually decreased between 2006 and 2015, which was the period that was studied. Not by a lot. Look at the Gini coefficient, which is the main measure, or primary measure that people use to look at inequality, when one shows complete inequality and zero would be perfect equality. In 2006, Gini in South Africa was 0.67. This declined to 0.65 by 2015, which is very high. But if we look just within South Africa's race groups, the most unequal race group is black South Africans. They have a Gini coefficient of 0.57, and that's actually an increase of nearly 6% since 2006. And it's actually white South Africans are the most equal within their race group. So what does this tell us? I think it's actually quite self-evident. Opportunities and so on have been gone to a relative elite in South Africa. So it's people who have had tertiary education, who have had access to opportunities or to contacts, who've been able to get them into the formal economy and so on. And I think this just shows we really have to ask ourselves some hard questions about whether policies such as BE and Employment Equity have worked. If we say that the point of post-1994 South Africa was to change the color of the elite, then we've done very well, I think. But it's a nice, nice mixed elite now, I think. But the vast majority of poor people and are still black. And actually, it shouldn't matter what color poor people are. We should just be focusing on helping poor people. That is what we need to do. And I think that is what this government has a short, as a blind spot to that. And I think that's why, part of the reason why we're in quite a lot of trouble at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. So, and Gwenya recently made a very good point about, you know, discussing merit and acknowledging, which I think is important to acknowledge, that that people who've come from an advantaged background are going to have their merit worthiness enhanced. It's just a matter of course. They might imagine that what they've achieved on the basis of their own merit. But in fact, that merit worthiness is something that needs to be provided or can be provided or can be absent.
Exactly.
And in our case, it's absent to a very large extent, and that's what we need to focus on.
Just an aside, just with all this debate about the DA leadership, everybody's saying that the DA needs a black leader. Or certain people. I'm pretty sure if Gwen had become the leader of the DA, they wouldn't say, oh, everything's fine now, the DA's got a black leader. So it just shows you the actual hypocrisy of these types of people.
Yeah. Well, you know, funnily enough, I saw there was an online video done by a certain journalist with a sometimes controversial reputation about Mayor Herman Mashaba. Now, I remember when he stepped down, there was this wave of indignation about, you know, like how could this happen? But I don't think – I think in the 15 minutes of commentary where he spoke to a number of analysts and trade unions and, you know, political opponents and the EFF and whatever, I don't think anyone had a positive word to say about him. So it's kind of, well, which is it? You know, if you if somebody is leaving, you know, because they performed poorly, then let us say good riddance. But this idea that, well, you know, the DA has committed a mortal sin by dispensing with a leader whom, you know, 6 months before, you know, we were ridiculing, and there's something very intellectually and ethically untidy about.
Well, if you go search on Twitter, for example, and you put in Herman Mashaba's name or Musi Maimane's name, and you put some of these vile terms that black people are called sometimes, such as Uncle Tom or House Negro or even worse things, and you see these things that were flung at people like Herman Mashaba and Musi Maimane until basically they left the DA. So it shows you, I mean, it's one of the most racist things in the world, actually, and a lot of our media class is actually guilty of this. Black South Africans a lot of people think black South Africans have to think a certain way, and if they don't, there's something wrong with them. They've been brainwashed or they've been bought or something. I mean, we see sometimes how people speak to our colleague Sihle Ngobesi. I think that's a good example. And I mean, nobody questions if a white person says they're liberal. Nobody says, no, you must be bought or brainwashed. But if a black person says they're liberal, they must be bought or brainwashed. I mean, it's actually, and nobody says if a white person says they're socialist or communist, they say there's something wrong with you. No, you've obviously arrived at that point of view through a certain process. Nobody claims that a white person will now be brainwashed or bought. I mean, it's actually, and I think it shows the kind of bigotry that a lot of people don't admit that they have, but I think it's something that exists in South Africa.
You know, I do also think, and I speak as someone with ambivalent views towards the Democratic Alliance myself, that the manner in which much of the media, and I mean people whose views are not extreme, let's say, are sort of more or less in the center of our media class, hold the DA to, I wouldn't say hold them to a particular standard, but single them out for a type of criticism or abuse that is completely disproportionate. Gareth Nonsen has made this point.
Yeah, Gareth's written very well on this.
I mean, we see some issues in the leadership of the city of Tshwane at the moment with certain recordings and certain untoward behaviours. I can't imagine, you know, and this is being, you know, being portrayed as a very serious indictment of the moral caliber and fitness for office of the Democratic Alliance. I can't even imagine this this being flagged if it was if it was the ANC. I mean, you have a situation where someone like Tony Ngeni, a very rare bird who's actually been imprisoned for corruption, becomes the ANC's, you know, moral guardian. And although there are people who will shake their heads, it just doesn't seem to dent the faith. And that, I think for a great many people in that sort of media commentary academia space, there's this longing for, you know, the true virtuous ANC of, you know, of the imagination.
The early 90s, that kind of.
Well, I mean, I don't even believe it that it really existed.
No, of course, but that was how it was kind of perceived. Yes. As always this, you know, noble organization. Yeah. I think there's a joke you can make about the ANC, which is actually about an immigrant to Australia, where a man arrives at a Thule house. So he'd like to become a member of the ANC. So the guy says, "Do you have a criminal record?" He says, "I don't know, we're still required." But anyway, I think that's probably all we've got time for today. I just want to mention to anybody who's listening and hasn't done so yet, the deadline for submissions on the NHI bill is Friday. So if you're worried about NHI and what it's going to do to South African healthcare, I encourage you to go look at our submission on our website, rrr.org.za. And if you agree with what we say there, please fill in your name. That'll go to Parliament, and we'll show that there's a groundswell of support against NHR. And we're not just saying NHR is bad. We're giving our own proposals and what we think we should do to reform the South African healthcare sector. And you also encourage your friends and family to have a look at that if they haven't done so. And if you're listening to this and you're not already a friend of the IRR, SMS your name to 32823, or you can go to our website. As I mentioned, that's irr.org.za, and there's a big red join button there. Then you can just push that and then follow the prompts. And if you want to support us and the work we do, then you can give us a contribution every month. However small or however large, it's up to you. So just like to say thanks to my colleagues who are here today, Terence, Ian and Michael. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And as they say, the Collective 94 Group of White Men is a podcast. So thanks, and we'll catch you guys on Friday.